Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, the 11th of March, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. Here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. From the front page of the Times, from firearms to tenure. This is an article by Thomas Geyer. Legislators discuss guns for school staff and term limits. Guns in the hands of school staff, who should determine how funds are distributed to community colleges, and term limits for Iowa's elected officials were among the subjects raised at an Iowa legislative forum held Saturday at Scott Community College. About 40 people attended the forum that featured Senator Cindy Winkler, Democrat for District 49, and Representatives Gary Moore, Republican for District 93, Norlin Momsen, Republican for District 70, and Monica Kurth, Democrat, for District 98. The forum initially was scheduled for the last weekend in March, but was moved up to avoid a conflict with Easter weekend. The forum was sponsored by Scott Community College and the American Association of University Women. Questions from the audience were written on cards and read to the panel by the moderator, former Iowa State Senator Maggie Tinsman. Asked about who should determine how state funds are distributed to the 15 community colleges in the state, Moore, who was a community college administrator for 41 years, said it should be up to the college presidents. Moore said that while he's concerned about how much money is appropriated to the community colleges, he thinks the college should decide how it's distributed. He said, "Let's let the presidents of the community colleges determine how the funding should be distributed. If 10 of the college presidents agree on a formula, then that would be a formula that would be adopted, and I'm in favor of that." Winkler said she was on the subcommittee of the bill and that it did pass that committee and passed appropriations. The Senate added a little more information to the bill. She said, "I'm in favor of it." Both Momsen and Kurth agreed with their colleagues, with Kurth saying saying that the administrators have the best idea of how the money needs to be allocated. Another question from the audience had to do with a bill that allows school staff to be armed if they get training. House lawmakers passed the Republican-backed House File Bill 2586 by a vote of 61-34. In addition to allowing for a permit to school personnel to carry guns on campuses, the bill would require the state's largest districts to hire security officers or school resource officers in high school buildings unless such a measure is voted down by the district school board. Kurth said she voted against the bill, saying, "The answer to gun violence is not more guns." She said she was talking to a former Marine about the issue and said she was told that no amount of training can safely put guns in the hands of teachers. In addition, the question was brought up during debate that if the teacher is armed with the gun, how is he or she also going to protect his or her students, Kurth said. Momsen said the bill doesn't force anybody to carry a firearm. He said that's the responsibility of the school district to choose to or not to arm school personnel. The law reads school personnel. It doesn't force anybody. The training is rigorous, and they'll be training with law enforcement. Winkler said the issue has been discussed in the Education Committee, but hasn't been discussed on the Senate floor. Moore said that teachers can carry guns in school now. It's just that most people don't know that fact. He said, "What this bill says is that if the teacher is going to carry a gun, they're going to have training." Spirit Lake and Cherokee school districts reversed decisions to allow armed staff after their insurance providers said it would stop covering them, and the districts were unable to find other insurance. The bill is an attempt to add training so that districts that allow for carrying of guns can get insurance. It also removes civil liability if a bad incident happens, Kurth said. When the question about term limits for governor and legislators arose, Moore stated that he can be on every side of that question. "I have seen excellent legislators who've been in office 10, 20, 30 years," he said. The advantage of having experienced legislators is that they know the system and how to get things done. Moore added that he has seen bad legislators who were there 2 or 4 or 6 years who never learned the system, and then it's the bureaucrats who are running the government, not the legislators. He said he looks at the 2-year election cycle as his term limit. If my constituents don't like the job I'm doing, they can throw me out every 2 years, he said. Winkler voiced a similar opinion. If they're not happy with the job I do, they can vote me out, she said. Momsen said before getting it, now that's not the case. There's a knack to knowing the system, he said, adding that experience and learning the system is key to getting things done. Kurth simply said to their comments, I agree. Jeff?
Illinois underfunds public universities by $1.4 billion. A state commission created in 2021 has issued a new report calculating that public universities in Illinois are underfunded by approximately $1.4 billion. The Commission on Equitable Public University Funding is made up of 34 members, including legislators, representatives from public universities, and members of advocacy organizations. Among the downstate educational leaders serving on the commission are Andrew Tarhule, interim president of Illinois State University, Dan Mahoney, president of Southern Illinois University, Lisa Freeman, president of Northern Illinois University, Jiyu Hong, president of Western Illinois University, and Matt Bierman, vice president and business affairs at Eastern Illinois University. It found that dedicating an added $100 million to $135 million annually to public universities would allow the state to bridge the funding gap in 10 to 15 years. The commission's co-chair, Senator Kimberly Lightford, a Democrat from Westchester, was among several of its members to outline its findings to a Capital News conference on Wednesday. When institutions are underfunded, they're unable to provide the necessary resources and support to all students, Lightford said. This perpetuates a cycle of inequalities, where those from affluent backgrounds have access to better education and subsequently better opportunities, while others are left behind. Without state funding, the financial burden has fallen on students. Ralph Mattier, executive director of the left-leaning Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, said the amount of operational funding covered by the state has decreased from 72% covered in 2002 to 35% in 2021. Mattier said as the cost to students goes up, college becomes less accessible. Lack of access to higher education perpetuates systemic issues such as income inequality. We are making higher ed more affordable for everyone in Illinois generally, said Mattier, who served on the commission, but in particular for low-income families and families that have been marginalized for decades. Higher education has seen increased funding under the Pritzker administration, notably for the Monetary Award Program, or MAP, grants. In the current fiscal year, the state allocated over $700 million in MAP funding, up from about $401 million when Pritzker took office in 2019. The state's total higher education budget is just over $2.5 billion in the current fiscal year. Commission co-chair Representative Carol Emmons from Urbana said that while investments including MAP, have helped students and universities, more needs to be done. She said for decades, the state has used a system that largely provides resources based on the negotiations that happen across the board, but all institutions are not the same. Janice Jackson, CEO of Hope Chicago, said in an interview that the commission looked at student needs as well as the support and funding that first-generation, low-income, and minority students may need, not only to get into college, but more importantly, to persist and complete college. The commission has been working to develop a formula to bridge the gap in funding. By setting targets for each university and subtracting their established resources, the commission calculated the gap in funding for each public university. Public universities, including all sources of available funding, are currently at 68.5% funding adequacy, collectively. The single most important driver of student success and equity in higher education is in our control. We can control what we invest and how we invest it, Robin Steens, a commission member and president of the educational advocacy group Advance Illinois, said. And you may be wondering, why haven't we done that before? And part of it is we didn't have a roadmap. We do now. The commission looked at funding models, including Tennessee and California, as well as Illinois' K-12 evidence-based funding model. The commission decided to base the higher education formula on the K-12 model. This may sound familiar, but by the way, because this is what we did in K-12 to remarkable success in national acclaim. Steen said, it's more complicated to do it in higher education. The K-12 model sets an individual funding adequacy target for each district and calls for an added $350 million in state funding each year. The bulk of that money is directed to districts that are furthest from the adequacy target. The commission laid out three possible timeframes for bringing districts closer to funding adequacy. In the first, if the state increased funding by $135 million annually, or 12%, all public universities would be fully funded in 10 years. If the state invested $100 million more annually, a 9% annual increase, all institutions would be fully funded in 15 years. If the state committed a 5% If the state committed a 5% funding increase, or about $60 million each year, the statewide target would increase from 68.5% to 79%, according to the report. Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget proposals for the upcoming fiscal year 2025 would increase public university funding by about $24.6 million. The commission's report will be part of subject matter hearings next week. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. Augustana College and Trinity College of Nursing and Health Sciences are partnering for a new direct entry nursing program to give students a quicker pathway to earning their degrees and entering the field. Under this 2+2 program, students will earn a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, a BSN, degree after completing 2 years at Augie and 2 years at Trinity. Eligible high school students admitted to Augie were assured a spot in Trinity's BSN program and will learn from faculty co-advisors from both institutions. Augie President Andrea Talentino said, "This pathway creates an opportunity for students interested in the health field to carve a clear path toward their future nursing career. It also strengthens Augustana's longstanding and valued partnership with Trinity College in building the next generation of medical professionals." Direct entry BSN applicants must meet several qualifications, including, first, earning a 3.2 minimum recalculated high school GPA their junior year. Second, completing at least 3 years of high school level science, including at least one lab course. Third, completing at least 3 years of high school mathematics and English. The program aims to equip students to make an immediate impact in healthcare across the Quad Cities and the nation, a press release from Augie said. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, employment for registered nurses is projected to grow 6% from 2022 to 2023, faster than the average for all occupations. The new 2+2 partnership accelerates students entering the healthcare field without sacrificing quality educational opportunities and experiences, said Trinity College Chancellor Dr. Tracy Polvordi, also an Augie 87 graduate. This collaboration comes at a critical time when nurses are in high demand, both locally and nationally. Trinity College of Nursing and Health Sciences is proud to be part of the solution in developing highly skilled and educated healthcare leaders. While she's confident Augie students have always been prepared for the rigors of a competitive nursing program, Talentino said the new 2+2 program offers a simplified path for students to enter such a high-demand field. To Polvordi, this partnership also aligns with the missions of both colleges, and the joining of Augie and Trinity's nursing education will yield well-prepared graduates. In 2019, Augie and Trinity partnered for an accelerated Bachelor of Arts to a Master of Science in Nursing program, allowing students to complete both degrees in 6 years.
Is the Betelgeuse star to explode? This star is consuming its own fuel, destined to collapse in on itself. This is the Quad Cities Skywatch column. And a side note, there's a couple of paragraphs here about how to pronounce Betelgeuse. The most popular pronunciation can be rendered as Betelgeuse, as I've said, making the star the namesake of a popular movie released in 1988. While it's more common to pronounce the first syllable in Betelgeuse with a long E, like the root vegetable, it's also acceptable to pronounce with a short E, like the word for placing a wager. Also, pronounce the last syllable with a Z sound, like Jews, rather than the more common S sound. So we'll start this article over and say Betelgeuse, how about that, is going to explode. Last month, we highlighted the winter football, a bright group of stars visible in the night sky during winter that form a pattern looking somewhat like a football. This month, as winter yields to spring, let's highlight one of the more interesting stars found within the winter football, a star which is someday may shine so brightly that it will be visible during the day. That star is Betelgeuse, the brightest star in the familiar constellation Orion, also known as the Hunter. Betelgeuse is a first magnitude star, which means that's very bright, and rates in the top 10 in terms of brightness when it comes to visible stars. Though, as we'll see, it has moved down that list and should eventually move to the top. Many individual stars have names derived from Arabic, and Betelgeuse is no exception. Found from our perspective in the northern hemisphere, in the upper left portion of Orion, Betelgeuse is roughly translated as the arm of the Hunter. It is also often referred to somewhat indelicately as the armpit of Orion. Well, Betelgeuse is estimated to be 640 light years from Earth. However, due to its unique characteristics, its distance is difficult to measure, so it may be somewhat closer or further away. Keep in mind that a light year is a measure of distance, not time. It's the distance that a beam of light travels in one Earth year. This means that the light we see from Betelgeuse actually departed the star centuries ago. Betelgeuse is classified as a red supergiant star, and indeed it does appear to have a reddish tint, And it's indeed a giant, certainly in comparison to the star closest to us, our own sun. The radius of Betelgeuse is more than 600 times that of our sun. This means that if you were to place Betelgeuse in the center of our solar system, it would engulf Earth. In fact, it would engulf Mars as well and extend out to the orbit of Jupiter. Though it's much brighter than our sun, Betelgeuse isn't nearly as hot. Its surface temperature is about 5,100 degrees Fahrenheit, which is plenty warm, but still about half that of our sun. Astronomers estimate Betelgeuse is about 100 million years old. As stars go, that's very young. But Betelgeuse is, in fact, a geriatric star in the final stages of its life. As a red supergiant, Betelgeuse is pulsing in and out, making it variable in both size and brightness. For about a year, beginning in early 2019, Betelgeuse dimmed noticeably before returning to its more familiar magnitude. Astronomers are still not sure what caused this, although some now theorize it may have been due to a sudden burst of dust and gas from the star's surface. Astronomers are sure that Betelgeuse is rapidly consuming its own fuel and is destined to collapse in on itself. Because it's so massive, it will create a remnant that could turn into a neutron star or even a black hole, neither of which would be visible to the naked eye. In this process, Betelgeuse will essentially explode. When and if this happens, Betelgeuse will become much brighter from our perspective. It's thought that it will shine at least as bright as a half moon. The moon is sometimes visible in the daylight during this phase, and so might the Betelgeuse at the height of its explosion. A star that undergoes that sort of transformation is known as a supernova, meaning the new big star. Exploding stars have been observed by ancient astronomers who saw them as new objects suddenly appearing out of nowhere and watched them in awe as they shined brightly and then slowly blinked out of sight. One observed supernova of the past evolved into what we now call the Crab Nebula. The explosion of Betelgeuse will cause some destruction in its celestial neighborhood, but poses no threat to us. From our safe distance, we'd see Betelgeuse as put on a spectacular show in the sky that would be a wonder to behold. If you'd like to see this happen, well, don't hold your breath. Given the speed of light and Betelgeuse's proximity to the Earth, if the armpit of Orion exploded at about the time Christopher Columbus crossed the Atlantic, we still might not see it in our lifetimes. It's also possible that the explosion is still thousands or even a few million years into the future. There are activities planned for the solar eclipse on April 8th. More on that in next month's Skywatch. To learn more about our club and the public events that we have planned, visit our website, popularastronomyclub.org, or visit us on Facebook. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And for those of you who were wondering about the Oscars last night and didn't watch, here's a quick run-through of the winners for the 96th Academy Awards. The Best Picture, Oppenheimer. And for directing, Christopher Nolan, for directing Oppenheimer. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce this name. Cillian Murphy, who is also a male. Cillian is a name I am not familiar with. Actress in a leading role, Emma Stone in Poor Things, I guess that is. Best actor in a supporting role, Robert Downey Jr. for Oppenheimer. Best actress in a supporting role, Divine Joy Randolph in The Holdovers. Best original screenplay, Anatomy of a Fall. Best adapted screenplay, American Fiction. Best international feature film, The Zone of Interest, and that's the United Kingdom. Best animated feature film, Boy and the Heron. Best animated short film, War is Over, inspired by the music of John and Yoko. Best documentary feature film, 20 Days in Mariupol. Best documentary short film, The Last Repair Job. The Last Repair Shop. Best live action short film, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. Best cinematography, again, Oppenheimer. Best film editing, again, Oppenheimer. Makeup and hairstyling, Poor Things. Best production design, Poor Things. Oh, best costume design, Poor Things. Original score, Oppenheimer. Original song, What Was I Made For? From Barbie. Best sound was The Zone of Interest. And best visual effects, Godzilla Minus One. Jeff?
As Saks Fifth Avenue's return area... Saks Fifth Avenue's return area at its Manhattan flagship, shoppers now see a camera and signage highlighting the enhanced video surveillance and a new policy. Customers must now show a photo ID. The company is also looking for ways to better scrutinize returned packages sent back to its warehouse. Saks increased measures to be rolled out in all 39 stores in some form. They're among the latest moves that a growing number of retailers, including Macy's, are taking to combat a rise of return fraud, particularly online, seen in the past 2 years. Other steps include mandating receipts and charging return fees. It's a problem worth $101 billion, affecting 13.7% of all returns, according to the National Retail Federation. Luxury is a big target for return fraud because it involves big-ticket items. Online return fraud includes the return of stolen items, worn items, counterfeit versions, and an item that's roughly the same weight as the one in the original box being returned. These items somehow turn up in the inventory system and then are sent back to customers. It also encompasses fraudsters claiming they never received an item or that they ordered online in an attempt to get a product free. Mark Metrick, the CEO of Saks, Saks Fifth Avenue's standalone online business, and a member of the executive committee of the National Retail Federation, spoke recently about the industry-wide issue and how it's being addressed. His answers have been edited for length and clarity. Here's a question. When did online return fraud start to be a problem? His answer, we moved into problem territory over the last couple of years, as I think stores, including Saks, moved to protect goods, protect the consumer. You're enabling goods more than you ever did before. You're cabling goods more than you ever did before. So like every type of bad actor, as one door closes, they find another window to go through, and online was that door. Question, how big of a problem is online return fraud at Saks? The answer, it's a very small percentage. It's not yet statistically a problem. We handle 9 million packages a year, but at Saks, one thing is going out like that is too many. Final question, how will more scrutiny affect the time shoppers get their refunds for returns? The answer, right now, it might not add much time. But if this gets to be more and more pervasive, we'll have to do it, and it's not fast. This is an industry issue. Carol?
Thanks, Jeff. And now it's time for obituaries. And today we have one pending funeral and one obituary. Catherine J. Rafferty, 100 years old, of Davenport, passed away Saturday, March 9th, 2024, at the Call Home, Davenport. Arrangements are being made by Halligan McCabe DeVry Funeral Home in Davenport. And one obituary, it's for Laura Holland Coyle, who was born October 5th, 1928, and died January 29th, 2024. In Cleveland, Ohio, formerly of Rock Island, Laura Holland Coyle, 95, died January 29th, 2024. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 14th, 2024, at Whelan Presley Funeral Home, 3030 7th Avenue, Rock Island, Illinois, with a rosary being recited at 4:30 p.m. A Mass of Christian Burial will be at 9 a.m. on Friday, March 15th, 2024, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Rock Island. Laura grew up in Rock Island, attended Sacred Heart School through 8th grade, and graduated high school from St. Joe's. She then entered nursing school at St. Anthony's. In 1951, she entered a nursing internship in New York City at the Polyclinic, doing rotations at several city hospitals in all specialties. She went on to a long and varied nursing career, becoming one of the first industrial nurses. Her later career years saw her providing home medical care as well as hospice care and Eucharistic ministry. Laura Holland married James Coyle in 1953. They raised four children in the close-knit blocks of family and friends a few doors from where she grew up. They attended Sacred Heart Church in Rock Island, and all their children attended and graduated from Sacred Heart and Alleman High School. Growing up in a large family, Laura was dedicated to her family, her sisters and brothers being her best friends. She loved family gatherings, being together, what she held most dear, her family and food. Those left to honor her memory are children, Michael Coyle and Andrea Milford, Connecticut, Mary Von Hoch, H-O-C-H, and Gary of Avon, Ohio, Tim Coyle and Dana of Vero Beach, Florida, 9 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, her daughter Paula Bowden, and 8 brothers and sisters. Please see full obituary at www.whelanpresley.com.
Turning now to the opinion page. Today's topic, from Ronald to Donald. The first opinion authored is entitled, Two Republican Leaders Have a Lot in Common. It's written by Megan Mobbs, who is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Voice. She writes, President Ronald Reagan is remembered as one of America's greatest presidents. He oversaw the end of the Cold War, creating an exceptional period of peace and an unparalleled economic boom. His policies made Americans safer and more prosperous. He has an almost mythical place today in the minds of many Republicans and the political class. Yet many who celebrate Reagan's achievements fail to acknowledge similar accomplishments made under former President Donald Trump. They perpetuate the misapprehension that the modern-day Republican Party is somehow vastly different from the 1980s grand old party. As Chris Christie recently said, quote, Ronald Reagan would not have recognized the Republican Party. He's wrong. His comment and others like it are the byproducts of a bizarre revisionist history. The essence of modern republicanism has not changed, just the tone and tenor of some of the messengers. Being a Republican today remains deeply rooted in the same bedrock ethos of yesteryear: personal responsibility and government accountability. From there, all else is derived: limited government, a free market economy, secure borders, safe cities, and peace through strength. Detractors decry today's Republican Party as being corrupted by anti-immigration and pro-authoritarian stances. This fails to recognize that what's happening at the border is not just immigration. Most Americans support legal immigration, as did Reagan. But 78% of Americans classify the border as either a crisis or a major problem, according to a survey by the Pew Research Center. Securing the border is a needed step to have a functioning immigration policy and remain a city on the hill to which people aspire to come. Similarly, the world is not all that different from the one Reagan inherited when he defeated President Jimmy Carter. Back then, the Soviet Union was expeditionary and expansive. Iran was emboldened and took aggressive action against the United States, and we faced a series of domestic economic problems. Reagan was elected in no small part because of a growing unease and mistrust of government. Americans were frustrated with the big spending on social programs that had little effect or physical oversight. Bureaucracy was growing unchecked, which led to overregulation and hurt American workers. Blind investment in international agencies failed to meet American standards and principles. Sound familiar? Reagan upended his time's existing state of affairs and was frequently lambasted for it. Many wear retroactive rose-colored glasses. But let's remember, Reagan pulled the United States out of UNESCO, cut off U.S. contributions to U.N. funds, and withheld dues. Reagan was criticized by his party as indulging the get the U.S. out of the U.N. syndrome. This is not dissimilar to Trump's White House suspending funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Reagan likewise railed against those who blame America for the ills of the world, no matter the bad actions of others. During his remarks at the annual dinner of the Conservative Political Action Conference, Reagan lauded his achievements. In 5 short years, we have seen the kind of political change rarely seen in a generation on nearly every issue. Federal spending, tax cuts, deregulation, the fight against career criminals and for tough judges, military readiness, resistance to Soviet expansionism, and the need for candor about the struggle between freedom and totalitarianism. Trump and the current Republican movement achieved nearly all of that in 4. Reagan remarked in his farewell address to the nation, quote, "The fact is, what they called radical was really right. What they called dangerous was just desperately needed," end quote. Certainly, Trump does not always exemplify Reagan's countenance as a happy warrior. Some of that may be specific to Trump, though we live in a coarser time. But when it comes to a policy and a government vision, being a Republican means that what it always has meant in the modern era. It's not the GOP that's lost its way. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And the second opinion under Ronald Donald is entitled, "Reagan Would Not Be Welcome in the GOP Today." It's written by Edwin Oswald, co-author of From Ronald to Donald, How the Myth of Reagan Became the Cult of Trump. And here's how he begins. How did Ronald Reagan's Republican Party become former President Donald Trump's? That is a question asked by many of the GOP faithful. Though Reagan was the first MAGA president, he ran for the White House in 1980 on the slogan, "Let's make America great again," he would not be welcomed in today's Republican Party. The brand of Reagan's GOP is no more. For starters, Reagan's policies on immigration were far more liberal than those of today's GOP. Reagan issued a statement on United States immigration and refugee policy announcing his intention to continue the American tradition of welcoming immigrants. He also called for millions of undocumented illegal immigrants, that was in a quote, then living in the United States to be offered a path to legal status. On November 6, 1986, he signed into law the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, which, among other provisions, granted what Reagan called amnesty to 3 million immigrants. For Reagan, immigration was a unique cornerstone of American vitality and renewal, and it was central to his own origin myth. In contrast, when Trump announced his candidacy in June of 2015, he attacked immigrants by saying, "When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people." After being sworn in as president, Trump signed an executive order banning travel from 7 predominantly Muslim countries to the United States for 90 days and later instituted a zero-tolerance policy at the southern border that separated children from parents of immigrants arrested while attempting to enter the United States. Unlike Reagan, today's GOP has used immigration to divide Americans and to make immigrants the scapegoats for a range of domestic ills, including income inequity. Reagan, a defender of the NATO alliance, took office after 4 decades of the Cold War with the former Soviet Union. Impatient with the slow-grinding nature of the post-war containment policy, Reagan turned his foreign policy on a redefinition of America's stance toward the Soviet Union. He believed the Soviet Union was a, quote, evil empire, as he called it in his speech on March 8, 1983. Later, in 1987 in Berlin, Reagan challenged then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to, quote, tear down this wall, unquote. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022 initiated the largest armed conflict in Europe since the end of World War II. Reagan would be shocked by Republican resistance to sending aid to Ukraine to fight Russia. Likewise, he would be incredulous at the flirtations with Moscow by some GOP members, such as recent statements by Senator Tommy Tuberville, a Republican from Alabama, about Putin's acumen. "You can tell Putin is on top of his game," Tuberville said while addressing Russia's posture on the Ukraine war. Trump referred to Putin's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine as smart and genius. At a campaign rally on February 10th, Trump encouraged Russia to do, quote, whatever the hell they want, unquote, to NATO members that Trump believed do not spend enough on defense. The GOP today has embraced Trump with cultish, some say cowardly, devotion. Trump has a civil conviction for sexual abuse and is now confronting 91 felony charges in 4 jurisdictions. Reagan, a proponent of immigration, a Cold War warrior, a man who gave that eloquent speech on defending freedom at Pont du Hoc on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, would say today what he once said about his prior affiliation with the Democratic Party years ago. "I did not leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me." Jeff?
Turning now to sports, here's what's on television today. Men's college basketball at 5:30 and 7:30 tonight on CBS Sports is the Coastal Athletic Conference semifinals. At 6 is the Southern Championship on ESPN. Also at 6, the Sun Belt Conference Championship on ESPN2. The Horizon League semifinals are at 6 and 8:30 on ESPNU, and at 8 and 10:30 are the West Coast semifinals on ESPN. College women's basketball at noon and 3 are the Summit League semifinals. That's on CBS Sports. At 1 o'clock, the Sun Belt Championship on ESPNU. At 1:30, the Big 12 semifinals are Iowa State and Oklahoma on ESPN2. And at 4, the other Big 12 semifinal game, Kansas State and Texas, also on ESPNU. And at 6 o'clock, the Big East championship on FS1. College softball, Florida plays Alabama on the SEC Network. And NBA basketball, Dallas plays Chicago at 7 o'clock on the NBC Sports Channel. And at 7 o'clock also, Golden State San Antonio on NBA TV. New Jersey at the New York Rangers. That doesn't sound like basketball. Must be hockey, 9:30 on the NHL Network. Spring training, noon, Pittsburgh versus the wonderful Boston Red Sox. That's on MLB Network. And at 3, the Los Angeles Dodgers and Cleveland play, also on MLB. Soccer, at 3 o'clock, in the Premier League, Newcastle at Chelsea. And tennis at 1 o'clock this afternoon, the APT and WTA from Indian Wells on the Tennis Channel. Carol.
Thank you, Jeff. And here's a college men's basketball. Number 12, Illinois, 73. Iowa, 61. Strong start and finish lift Illini. Dateline, Iowa City. Terrence Shannon Jr. scored 25 points. Quincy Guerrier had 14 and 13 rebounds. And number 12, Illinois beat Iowa, 73-61 on Sunday. The Illini, who are 23-8 and 14-6 in the Big Ten, built a big early lead and then pulled away late in the second half after letting the Hawkeyes, who are 18-13 and 10-10, get within 59-53 points with 6 minutes and 58 seconds left. Illinois, which finished 3 games behind the Big Ten champion Purdue, will be the number 2 seed in this week's Big Ten tournament in Minneapolis. The Illini could see the Hawkeyes again as they get Thursday's winner between Iowa and Ohio State in their game on Friday. The Illini were coming off a 77-71 home loss to Purdue on Tuesday, and Coach Brad Underwood said his team kind of practiced angry for a couple of days afterward. Underwood said, "We made every drill competitive with consequence. Everything was dialed up. Every mistake, there were consequences for. It was getting guys to understand effort." That effort showed early. The Illini opened with a 17-2 run in the first 6.5 minutes as the Hawkeyes missed 13 of their first 14 shots. Illinois center Danja said, "We got it going just by effort. I think that was because the last couple of days of practice, we practiced really hard. We locked back in on our defense, and it showed." The Illini led by 21 points before Iowa went on a 14-2 run, getting within 33-25 with 3 minutes 27 seconds to play, trailing 39-29 at halftime. "We kept fighting," Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey said. "We had good shots. It wasn't like I was going to criticize anybody for the shots we were taking. I thought we were taking good shots. I thought we were moving the ball. It was just frustrating for everybody." The Hawkeyes continued to cut into the Illini lead in the second half, getting within 51-47 with 11 minutes 15 seconds to play. But the Illini scored 6 points in 70 seconds to get the lead back to double digits and kept control from there. I think this group understands, I have to find my continuing page here. I think this group understands that teams make runs, especially good teams, Underwood said. They just kind of maintained. We got in the huddle. Everybody was positive. Everybody was upbeat. They were saying all the right things. Shannon had 18 points in the first half and finished 10 of 19 from the field, hitting 3 three-pointers. Peyton Sanford led Iowa with 23 points, 19 in the second half. Josh Dix had 13 points. Sanford said, "We missed some shots and normally make, and that happens." Illinois held Iowa to 35.4% shooting for the game. Our defense has really slipped the last couple games, Danger said. We really focused on that. Underwood appreciated the way the team slowed Iowa's offense. He said, they're as explosive as heck. You never feel comfortable, even with an 18 or 20-point lead. I thought we had some bite to us today. Marcus Damask added 11 points for the Illini. Hawkeyes, who were 5-5 in mid-December, had played themselves into NCAA tournament consideration in recent weeks, but could have used a win over a ranked opponent to close the regular season. Underwood said the Hawkeyes were an NCAA-worthy team. McCaffrey said, I think we have work to do. I appreciate what Brad said, and I think he's right. We've had some difficult wins in a really good league. It's not something you want to leave to chance. We want to do some more damage. Jeff?
On the women's side of college basketball, Iowa rallies and three-peats. After a slow start, the Hawkeyes defeat Nebraska in overtime. Caitlin Clark overcame a cold start to score 30 of her 34 points after halftime and helped third-ranked Iowa rally past Nebraska 94-89 in overtime to win a third straight Big Ten tournament on Sunday. It never really gets old cutting the net, Clark said after black and gold confetti covered the court at Target Center to the delight of another sellout crowd packed with Hawkeye fans. I feel like we're pretty good at that. Hannah Stolke had 25 points and 9 rebounds for Iowa, whose record is 29-4, which trailed by 13 points late in the first half, while their superstar Clark missed all 9 of her 3-point attempts. You can maybe keep Caitlin down for a half. You're not going to keep her down for a whole game, Hawkeye coach Lisa Bluter said. The all-time NCAA leading scorer finished 5-for-17 from deep, had 12 assists, and hit the dagger three-pointer with 51 seconds left in overtime for an 89-87 lead just 16 seconds after Logan Nisley's three-pointer put the Cornhuskers in front. I knew some shots were going to go in, Clark said. That's just how it works. Alexis Markowski had 23 points and 13 rebounds to lead Nebraska, whose record is 22-11, in a valiant performance that fell short of a second victory over Iowa this season. The Huskers beat the Hawkeyes 82-79 on February 11th. Nebraska coach Amy Williams, who had tears streaming down her face at the post-game interview podium as she praised Nisley's effort after her red-eyed players choked up during some of the remarks, said nobody else did, but we expected to win. Natalie Potts had 21 points and 9 rebounds for the Huskers, who led 75-67 with 2.5 minutes to go in regulation before Clark drained one of her signature step-back three-pointers. Her layup in traffic tied the game with 29 seconds left. Nebraska played for the final shot, and Nisley's baseline jumper was short at the buzzer. Clark waved her arms at the Iowa-dominated sellout crowd, yelling, "Come on, 5 more minutes." The Hawkeyes were well aware of Jazz Shelley, who had 16 points and 13 assists on that last possession of regulation after the Australian hit a three-pointer with 30 seconds left in the previous meeting. They tightened things up, Williams said. I would have, too. The Huskers played their fourth game in 4 days, beating Purdue, Michigan State, and Maryland to reach the conference final for the first time in 10 years. Despite the 11 a.m. Central tip-off and the lost hour for daylight saving time clock change, they didn't lack for energy. These regional rivals, one fan clutched a clever sign that read, "Iowa has better corn," from the conference's soon-to-be stretched way-out western edge, played a rugged and fierce game befitting their grinded-out matchups on the football field. Bodies banged hard against the floor often, and the pushing for position around the basket was intense. Markowski and Potts, the Big Ten Freshman of the Year award winner, played fearlessly inside after Iowa commanded a 54-16 points in the paint advantage on Michigan the day before. Clark mostly found her usual playable looks at the hoop, but the long ball just wasn't her friend. The Hawkeyes matched every bit of the Huskers' fire, though, and made sure they stayed within striking range by getting the ball to the basket as much as they could and locking down on defense. That's probably what I'm most proud of, that we found a different way to win, Clark said. Clark immediately bit into Nebraska's 46-35 halftime lead by hitting a step-back jumper from the free-throw line. Her first deep shot finally fell when she drifted right off the break and swished a pull-up from the wing to bring Iowa within 48-42, and she pumped her fist with a slight smile on the way back. Curling off high screens was a recipe for success. Clark gave the Hawkeyes their first lead since 5-4 when she did just that off a pass from Kate Martin, who hit all three of her three-pointers after the third quarter and smoothly drove in for a layup that made it 53-52. And that brings us to the end of the Quad Cities Times for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been the wonderful Carol Lockhart. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.